For today and tomorrow and Saturday, I have planned a mini-series of three presentations entitled Prophets, Wise Men, and Priests, Another Look at the Hebrew Scriptures. Prophets, Wise Men, and Priests, Another Look at the Hebrew Scriptures. Let me quickly explain to you the rationale of this topic and what I intend to do. Many of us have the experience that very often we study a given text of the Old or the New Testament in great detail and minutely. That is as it ought to be. But we also then have easily the impression that we fragment the biblical text, that we tend to see many individual trees and never the whole forest. In other words, what one needs to do in Bible study is one needs to look at the total picture as much as at the individual parts of the Bible. And therefore, my series for these 3 days is designed to give you, as it were, a bird's eye view of the Hebrew Scriptures. This is what I intend to do. Now, if one were to ask, how should one do this? After all, the Hebrew Bible, as you know, is a very substantial book. It is about this much. And to get a bird's eye view of that much literature is no easy undertaking. How to do it in 3 days? Some people would argue we should approach it historically. After all, the Old Testament is a book that arose during the history of a people, the people of ancient Israel, in the course of more than 1,000 years, and maybe one can proceed historically. Now, this is a perfectly good way of doing it, if you have enough time. 1,000 years are not readily covered in 3 days. In a seminary course or university course, where I have a whole quarter or maybe two, a semester to deal with it, that is very often the way in which I proceed, historically, by periods. I would begin with Abraham and the patriarchs, then would discuss Moses and Joshua at the times of the judges, then the first kings of Israel, Saul, David, and Solomon, then I would discuss the time of the monarchy and of the prophets, of Elijah and Elijah, of an Amos and an Isaiah, a Jeremiah. Then I would discuss the dark period of the exile and the prophetic voices we hear there, Isaiah of Babylon, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And then I would discuss the reconstruction after they returned, the building of the Second Temple and the rise of Judaism, running over into the period of the early rabbis and the early Christians. However, this is not the approach I would like to take. Another approach one could take would be a more literarily oriented one. After all, what we have in the Old Testament is the literature of a people that includes all facets of their life. Here you have songs that were sung from times immemorial. You have songs that accompanied their work, songs that accompanied them when they went to war or when they returned, songs that they sang when they worshipped. Or you have narratives, stories that were told around the campfire by bards, short ones and long ones, sad ones and amusing ones, some very crudely told, others masterpieces of literature. Or you have laws, many of them. You have whole collections of laws, and we could look at those. And I have not even mentioned the books of the prophets, or the poetical books, the Psalter, the book of Job, or the Preacher. Again, that would be a rather big bill, would it not? But again, that could be done had one more time. So I do not wish to take a historical approach. I do not wish to take a literary approach. Well then, what approach should I take? In the Old Testament, in a tucked away place, is an interesting passage that can supply us some pattern and clue as to how we might proceed. It is found in the book of Jeremiah. It is found in the 18th chapter, where we hear that Jeremiah, once again, was in trouble with his contemporaries. Then, as now, prophetic voices are not particularly welcome. And we read in the 18th chapter, and I'm telling all this simply to give you the background in order to focus in on the particular passage in which I'm interested. We read there that Jeremiah's contemporaries said to each other, look, we better get rid of this troublemaker. We get rid of him and then things will be all the better. Then society will properly function without this guy who throws a monkey wrench into all things. And this is now the passage in which I'm interested. It is found in the 18th chapter, in the 18th verse. Let me read it to you according to the translation of the Jerusalem Bible. Come on, they said, these contemporaries of Jeremiah who want to get rid of him. Come on, they said, let us concoct a plot against Jeremiah. And then follows a statement that really is sounds more like a footnote or should be put in parentheses because it explains the rationale of their argument, namely, good riddance, as far as Jeremiah is concerned. Let us concoct a plot against Jeremiah, for the priest will not run short of instruction without him, nor the sage of advice, nor the prophet of the word. Let me repeat it. They say, things will be all the better without this troublemaker, because still, priests will function all the better without him, prophets will function all the better without him, wise men will still be in business. The priest will not run short of instruction without him, nor the sage of advice, nor the prophet of the word. Now, friends, I'm interested only in this sentence, because what I have here in this aside, as it were, is nothing less than a mini sociology of ancient Israel. What I have here is a very brief description of the three basic offices, the three crucial functions in ancient Israel, at least in the time of Jeremiah, which was approximately 600 BCE. We learn from this passage that Israelite society, so to speak, is built on three pillars, on three offices, that of the priest, that of the wise man, and that of the prophet. It's very clear, is it not? More, we not only learn about these three offices, we are also told through what medium, through what instrument they exercise their office. We hear that the priest exercises the priestly office through, quote, instruction. The sage or the wise man or the philosopher, if you wish, through advice or counsel is another possible translation. And the prophet, that we well know already, through the word of the Lord. If I put it on the blackboard, it looks like this. There is the priest who is what he is through instruction. Then there is the wise man, or here in the Jerusalem Bible translated sage, and he offers advice, or you could also translate it counsel. And then finally there is the prophet, and he offers the word, or the word of the Lord.
May I interrupt for a
Yes, question? By all means.
And now, on the first one, you said the priest is what he is because of instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And the others, it's as though they give out advice, counsel, and the word. Is that wrong? Am I misunderstanding it?
No. You see, what we are dealing here with are definite words that have a definite meaning. When the word instruction is used, then it goes with the priest. That is what the priest does.
It's not how he becomes what he is.
No. That's how he operates. Like a preacher through his preaching or through his sermons, you see?
Yes.
A teacher through his lecture. In that sense, it's used.
Thank you.
Okay. Fine. Now, here we have a mini sociology of the Israel of the time of Jeremiah. Now, lest you think that this is an isolated passage, we have in Ezekiel chapter 7, verse 26, a very similar passage. Let me read it to you. Ezekiel chapter 7, verse 26. Again, I'm using the translation of the Jerusalem Bible. Here, and the context is not of interest to us, we read, disaster will follow on disaster, rumor on rumor. They will pester the prophet for a vision. The priest will not be at loss or will be at loss over instruction, and the elders on how to advise. Now here we have some terms that are different. We hear that the prophet offers a vision. And anyone who has read the prophetical books knows that the prophetic word and the prophetic vision go together. The priest is the one who hands out instruction. That's the same as in Jeremiah 18:18. But those who give advice, who give counsel, are the elders. And what is meant here is not so much a fixed office of elder, but those people, men and also women, who through experience or natural talents are able to be philosophers, to consider a matter wisely and then to speak to it. In other words, the two passages that I have picked out, one from Jeremiah and one from Ezekiel, give to us an idea as to what the three basic functions were in the Israel of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Now comes my next point. I would like to take this as the pattern for doing a bird's eye view of the Old Testament. In other words, I would like to use the rest of the time today to talk to you about priests and their instruction. Then tomorrow I will talk about wise men and their counsel. And on Saturday I will talk about the prophet and his word. But how can I be sure that this is a comprehensive and fair look at the Old Testament, that it is a bird's eye view? Well, friends, there is a very simple proof to that. When you read the New Testament and look there for references to the Old Testament, you will never find, by the way, the word Old Testament used in the New Testament with reference to the Hebrew Scriptures. That's a later Christian term for the Hebrew Scriptures. But what you do find, say for instance in Luke 24, is a reference to the Hebrew Scriptures as the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. And when you turn to a Hebrew Bible, you find that the Hebrew Bible is divided precisely into these three parts: the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. And I think it is not difficult to see now how this directly corresponds to this much older threefold division into what the priest does, what the wise man does, what the prophet does. These three constituted, through the history of ancient Israel, a very basic pattern. So basic that the Hebrew Scriptures, the canon of the Old Testament, was ordered in that fashion. Let me write it to the blackboard. You have the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings. Now, if you ask what belongs to what, then the Law comprises the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Prophets comprise not only what we commonly associate with the word prophet, namely Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets, but also what in Hebrew is called the former prophets, namely the historical books Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, plus Isaiah through the 12 minor prophets, which I abbreviated with the Roman numeral 12. And the rest belongs to the Writings, notably the Psalter, the Book of Job, the Book of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, etc. In other words, this threefold division that we observe approximately 600 BCE before the Common Era what is also evident in the Hebrew canon as it takes shape approximately in the time of Jesus. So it is a very persistent pattern, and furthermore a pattern that has shaped the Hebrew Bible and still shapes it today. Footnote, it's another matter, another question, and a fairly complicated one, to answer the question as to why our Protestant Bibles are somewhat different in arrangement and content. That requires some homework on your side and on my side in order to go into it, and this is not the time to do it, but that is the way in which the Hebrew Bible is arranged. Now this concludes the first part of my presentation today, namely the justification of this sort of an approach. And I think it becomes clear now to you why I've entitled the series Prophets, Priests, and Wise Men. I sometimes vary the order, you see, another look at the Old Testament. Let us then deal first with the priestly element in the Old Testament, in other words, with instruction. And for those of you who are interested, the word instruction in Hebrew is Torah, a word with which you may be familiar, which is now the technical term for the first part of the Hebrew canon, the law. And here we turn to another Old Testament passage which shows us, so to speak, priests in action. In other words, I will not now myself describe how priests offered instruction. I will turn to a text that illustrates that. Now, oddly enough, we find that text in one of the prophetical books, because the prophet Haggai uses it as an illustration for a point he wants to make. Now, that point he wants to make, of course, stands in its own right. But I am interested at this point only in the illustration, because it shows how, at least in the time of Haggai, priests operated. Let us turn to Haggai chapter 2. Haggai chapter 2. That is one of the 12 minor prophets. I am now using for reading the New English Bible. Haggai chapter 2, verse 10 following. In the second year of Darius, that's toward the end of the 6th century BCE, on the 24th day of the 9th month, this word came from the Lord to the prophet Haggai. These are the words of the Lord of hosts, and now comes the illustration. Ask the priests to give their ruling or their instruction. Now comes the question, to which the priest is to give instruction, an answer to a question. If a man is carrying consecrated flesh in a fold of his robe, I will explain some of these terms in a moment. If a man is carrying consecrated flesh in a fold of his robe, and he lets the fold touch bread or broth or wine or oil or any other kind of food, will that also become consecrated? Now, in order to understand this question, you have to know that the priests of old, not only those of ancient Israel, had to do with matters of ritually clean and ritually not clean, of holy and profane, technical terms which some of you may remember from courses in comparative religion, from college days. The priests are concerned, among other things, with separating out the profane from the holy, with knowing where the line runs. Ordinary people don't know that, or at least in many cases don't know that, and therefore have to turn to the priests for that specialized knowledge. No doubt we are entering here into a sphere that in many ways is alien to us, but that's the sphere in which we are here moving. Now, this particular question put to a priest talks of consecrated flesh, and that means meat from an animal that was ritually slaughtered. It was not an animal that had died by itself or had been torn by a wild animal. No, it was one that had been ritually slaughtered, maybe with the letter opener I showed you yesterday. At any rate, this then is meat that can be properly consumed and nothing untoward attaches to such consumption. But that's not the issue yet. The issue is, if someone carries a piece of such consecrated meat in the fold of one's garment, you have to imagine that they wore a big cloak held together, at least on cold days, with a belt, and there was, so to speak, a natural pouch there in which one would carry things. If one carries this sort of holy meat in such a pouch and then touches some other object, in this case, some food, does the holiness, the sacred quality of the meat, become contagious so that the other foodstuffs also become holy? It becomes fairly complicated, doesn't it? Never mind, bear with me or with the text. This is the question that was asked of the priests. Is this holiness contagious, or to what degree is it contagious? Now it takes a priest, of course, to answer that question. And the priests answered two letters, one word, lo, no. They knew their stuff, evidently. But what is implied here is that the consecrated meat that has this holy sacred quality to itself does not, by way of contagion, impart this holy quality to another object or to another piece of food. Next question. Haggai went on, but if a person defiled by contact with a corpse, in other words, it's the opposite now, if someone who is ritually unclean for a time, you understand these are not moral categories, these are religious, cultic categories. But if a person defiled by contact with a corpse touches any one of these things, will that also become defiled? And the answer, again very short, came, yes, it will, answered the priests. And then Haggai goes on and uses this as an illustration to make his point, in which we are now not interested, which of course stands in its own right. Now what you have here is a little case study as to how priests in ancient Israel operated, you see, and I have simply developed it out of what you actually read there. This is priestly instruction. Now you may say, that is rather far from what commonly we think religious instruction is. It seems to be so limited. It seems to be so complicated. It seems to relate to such an alien, far-off area, far away from us in terms of time and space. Well, this is not the whole story. When you look through the whole of the Old Testament, you observe that the notion of priestly instruction gradually, leaven-like, grew and took on an ever more comprehensive meaning. When you read the book of Deuteronomy, and let me not go into its historical background at this point, then you discover that here the word priestly instruction, the word Torah, has taken on a much wider meaning. It is no more just the individual priestly answer to a question such as this one, even though it can still mean this. No, it becomes written, we would say, with a capital T, and it becomes the sum total of all priestly instruction that is given to Israel. More, it becomes the sum total of God's gracious will that is expressed through the medium of priestly instruction. So that now the word law, Torah, has a much more comprehensive meaning, and certainly not a meaning that we are sometimes tempted to connect it in Latin Christianity, that of a requirement or of a demand. Note, all this priestly instruction is not a command, a requirement, but a statement. Or one could almost say, especially in people somewhat standing in the Lutheran tradition, it is much more gospel than law. It is the expression of God's gracious will for his people. And this is the way in which we then find the word priestly instruction, capital I, Torah, capital T, law, capital L, used in the later Judaism and in the Judaism of the intertestamental period. it becomes the sum total of God's gracious will as expressed in the tradition. And so it becomes a very comprehensive term, and you will now understand how it could even become the name for the whole first part of the Hebrew Bible, for the first five books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, which contains laws, all right, but many other stories as well. And it is in that comprehensive sense that it then can be used. And by way of conclusion, let me say, if you were now to turn to the Hebrew Scriptures, and with the eyes that I have given to you through this approach, look at them, you in this way have gotten hold of the first part of the Hebrew Scriptures, the law, God's gracious will, as set forth for his people in the first five books of the Old Testament. So far my presentation today. Now there is time to ask a few questions. Yes, please.
Is the way in which that will is gracious made explicit in the Torah?
Yeah. It is made explicit in the sense that in all cases it assures the people of Israel of their place in God's world, assures them of a room, a sphere within which they are to live. It is gracious in as far as it keeps affirming Israel, limiting it to a sphere, separating it from the rest of the world, but positively centering it in election and covenant. In that sense, I would use the word gracious here. Yes, please.
Where did the Pharisees fit into this situation?
Yes.
And now, the Sadducees.
Right.
The
Sadducees. That's a very good question. Yes, I'm glad to answer that question. Now, the words or the names Pharisees and Sadducees are names of groups that we find in the New Testament. You do not find them in the Old Testament. So let me say this first. There were in intertestamental Judaism, say the last 200 years before the time of Jesus, and then in the time of Jesus, several groups in Judaism. One Jewish historian calls them theological schools. One of them were the Sadducees. That was the priestly establishment, the priests in Jerusalem, who were on the whole very conservative and considered only the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures as sacred writ. Then there were the Pharisees. The Pharisees were a lay movement. They were not priests. The Pharisees on the whole were based more out in the country, especially in Galilee. And at times the Pharisees were very critical of the Sadducees. You get that in the New Testament, don't you? Now, the Pharisees were also very eager to maintain the tradition. But, they said, in order to maintain the tradition, the sacred tradition, it has to be constantly fenced in and constantly newly interpreted to adapt it to the new situation. The Sadducee says, no changes, please. The Pharisee said, we make changes, but faithful to the tradition. Now, these two groups were at odds with each other in the time of Jesus. And you observe in the Gospels that the young Christian movement, on the whole, was much closer to the Pharisaic movement. The Sadducees are not as much mentioned and get much more negative treatment. While with the Pharisees, Jesus and his disciples have a lot of conversations, you see. And in certain places they agree with each other, in certain places they disagree with each other. Now I could go on with this, but basically Sadducees and Pharisees belong to a later time, the New Testament time, which in the way in which I described it is connected to the Old Testament. Yes, please.
Then if you say they're a lay movement, they're not attached to the tribe of Levi?
No. The Pharisees, now let me put it this way. If you are a member of the tribe of Levi, you may well become a Pharisee. That's all right, but this is not what qualifies you. What qualifies you to be a Pharisee is piety. And in a way you could compare the Pharisaic movements, and there were several, to the pietistic lay movements that we have experienced in the history of the synagogue and of the church and of the mosque from time to time. Sometimes quite anti-establishment and anti-priestly, you see. Yes. There was a third group, by the way, the famous Essenes, the people who gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then there were still other groups like the Zealots, who hoped that they could by violence overthrow the Roman rule, and probably still more groups, but it would go too far to discuss these now. Time for one more question.
Do Ezra and Nehemiah go in with the writings?
Ezra and Nehemiah go in with the writings, yes. Actually, if you compare a Hebrew Bible with a Greek Bible, you are struck by the great difference between the two. And this is ultimately the reason why there's a difference between Roman Catholic and Protestant Bibles, you see. For instance, I've used here the Jerusalem Bible. In order to use the Jerusalem Bible, which is a Roman Catholic Bible, when you're used to King James Version or RSV or New English Bible, you have to know how these things are differently arranged. For instance, I've used here the Jerusalem Bible. In order to use the Jerusalem Bible, which is a Roman Catholic Bible, when you're used to King James Version or RSV or New English Bible, you have to know how these things are differently arranged. But that's a fairly complicated question. Basically, the Greek Bible was used by the Greek-speaking Jews across the Roman Empire, while the Hebrew Bible continued to be used by the scholars in Palestine itself. Now, tomorrow I intend to discuss the second category, the wise men, because they come second in Jeremiah 18, and by the way, also at special request of one of the faculty members here. So come back tomorrow morning after second sitting of breakfast. Thank you very much.